Just going to go over some basics about springtails and earthworm testing for the modifications that were made to some of the chemical tests already in place for genetically modified crops. And this is where I'm located, Springborn Smithers Laboratory in Wareham, Mass. This has already been covered pretty well in the previous talks, but just for those of you that might have just stepped in, just a very basic history. Genetically engineered crops have been widespread use since the 80s, regulated under FIFRA and the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. The white paper, which has already been discussed, was put out in 2007 as sort of a beginning step as a guideline for how to handle some of these plant-incorporated proteins. Two common soil inhabitants used in environmental testing currently are springtails and earthworms. Just for a quick background of them, this is Folsomia candida, one of the common springtails that is used in these tests. They're pretty small. They're about 5 millimeters in length, parthenogenic, fairly happy little things jumping around, feeding on fungus. Common soil inhabitants. One of the probably beneficial things about them is that they're fairly good representation of an insect because they're in a wide variety of habitats: soil, leaf litter, surface of ponds, fungus, even snow in some cases, the different species. So they make a good representative. Isania fetida, one of the red worms, is another common inhabitant of the soil. You can't really dig too many holes somewhere without running across some earthworms, so they're fairly common. It's something that is most likely going to encounter some of these proteins. Here is just an example of their cocoons that they produce, and this particular species will produce on average about 3 organisms from each cocoon. And this is sort of a size difference between them. The cocoon is, I guess I can use this, the cocoon is right here, sort of a size comparison for the earthworm. For chemical testing, there's typically a 100-fold limit, and for the soil tests, it's 1,000 milligrams per kilogram testing limit, which can serve as the limit of the test. A lot of times, the range that the LD50s or some of these other values you're trying to find, you don't have any historical data to suggest what the definitive range should be. So you would have sort of this range finding test just so you could identify what range you're talking about to close in on that number as best as you can. The two common tests in the guidelines, there's a 14-day earthworm acute test, which the endpoints is mortality, although we do record observations like lethargic behaviors, segmentation, and we also record the weights of the earthworms as well. But mortality in this case is the primary endpoint. For springtail chronic testing, it's a 28-day study, you can go through the entire reproductive cycle, and you're measuring mortality again and offspring per adult. For chemical testing, the product is typically added, if it's water soluble, into the water first and then into the mixtures. If it's not, you'll need to deliver it with something else like acetone or some other volatile that you can evaporate it off. You remove a portion of the sand from the mix and evaporate that under a hood so it's mixed in with the sand before you mix it in with the complete soil mixture. And then there's also spraying the surface, which kind of mimics sort of a field application. Here's just an example of the test system, which is just a 1-liter beaker. Approximately 600 grams of soil, artificial soil, is placed in this, and about 10 earthworms, not about, exactly 10 earthworms, at 2 to 12 months of age. For chemical testing, we found that we've also mixed it in directly with the food instead of mixing it with soil. And there are certain advantages to that. We use the same plaster charcoal mix that's used in the culture, so there's no sort of acclimation issues that you have to worry about. It's also easier to keep to clean the fungus that can develop from the food that you're feeding them, and keep track of the health during the exposure. It's a 28-day exposure, and sometimes it's nice to be able to weekly observe these organisms under a microscope to find out how you're progressing. In case it got too dry in there and maybe they all died after the first week, you're not waiting an additional 3 weeks to just restart the test. So it's kind of nice that if you take some time under a dissecting scope, you can really monitor the health and egg laying and any other issues that might crop up. Because with the soil system, they're kind of hard to see. There's cracks and crevices, and they are small insects that can kind of blend in. And it can be hard to keep track of them. So so that type of test system looks like this. It's they're 4-ounce jars, approximately 1 centimeter deep of the substrate, which is again a plaster charcoal mixture. 10 organisms each are placed into each vessel, and they're about 10 to 12 days old. It takes about 3 weeks to generate the test organism because it'll take about 10 days for the eggs to hatch, and then you have to wait 10 to 12 days after that, approximately. Some of the considerations for testing would be that chemicals can be packaged in a concentration that might need to be diluted for a field application. And so for sort of a worst case, I can certainly imagine some end user not following the label instructions and receiving some sort of dose that he's not supposed to be, and worker exposure. And so I can certainly see why they might have these test exposure requirements of testing for 100-fold to cover some of these atypical exposures, sort of a worst case, but a reasonable one. As a quick background, most of the proteins that are incorporated in these plants are all BT-derived proteins. They're fairly specific. They work under a fairly specific pH range. Most animals have an acidic midgut, and the ranges that these work at are neutral to more of a basic level. And most of the species have this narrow band of pH ranges in their midgut, so that's why they tend to be a little bit more species or family specific. It's just something that tends to happen. It's not a generality. It effectively just causes starvation due to killed midgut cells. The BT genes are considered by the EPA to be a reduced risk pesticide, and which would explain why they typically see like a 10-fold testing limit for these to serve as a limit test, as opposed to the 100-fold in chemical testing. Range-finding exposures are also not necessary, due to the fact that they're not expecting to see any results in some of these non-target organisms. What's already been covered in some other talks is the fact that there's the use of two different sort of testing media, the purified protein from bacteria or the whole plant product itself. And it's mostly due to the difficulties in obtaining the quantities that you need for these tests, and that's pretty much the main reason why that's done. And in a manner similar to chemical testing, it's something that can be mixed in to the soil via the water, usually with a buffer, or directly into the soil, which doesn't create as a homogeneous mixture as using it with the water method. And in addition, we've also used it with just mixing it directly with the diet as well, and that's in the case of the springtails. We'll mix it in with the yeast diet. The whole plant material, we've run some tests where we have taken the whole plant material and incorporated it as a component to the soil in the mixtures for both earthworm and springtails. And we've also done it where we have mixed it in the food as well. And some of the considerations for a genetically modified protein, I mean a genetically engineered crop, the proteins, it's not something that the end user is typically going to be able to have control over as far as dosing. He can't misdose this or not dilute it properly, or there's not really a label per se to make some of those errors as in that you could with a chemical product. And the mode of action, again, this is something that's destroying stomach cells, and so the main effect is starvation. And it's not something that happens in a very rapid amount of time. It's something, that's why typically you want these tests to happen in like a 7-day or you certainly don't want something just 24 hours with this kind of thing. And that's something that's also been mentioned in previous talks in this symposia. Some other things to just consider is some sort of bioaccumulation, the fact that what's the effect of something like this if years after years this kind of crop is grown in these fields and it keeps getting mixed up into the soil. There have been EPA papers that have mentioned that some of these degradation rates for these BT proteins are along some sort of half-life at around 3 days. So it's not really expected to be in the soil for very long based on some of those papers I've seen. So this is just an example from an extension publication about how much material is actually going to be incorporated into the soil as far as to generate some sort of idea of what kind of rates to set for dosing. And so effectively, you would expect about 0.0018 kilograms of plant material per kilogram of soil. And so those are the rates that we have tested in a lab scenario. One of the things about springtails that seems to make it an appropriate test vessel is the fact that it has been observed that they will ingest plant material. I was thinking that initially if I mix some of this whole plant material that's really ground up with yeast, that they would just kind of, because it's small enough and it's not really a liquid diet, that they would kind of walk around the plant material and just ingest the yeast. But having observed different concentrations of plant material from, say, 20% all the way up to 90% of their diet composed of plant material, I've seen they're kind of like a transparent, almost white insect. And when they burrow into charcoal substrate, you can see their midgut turning black. And the same thing, I've seen them ingest plant material, and you can see their midguts being sort of this greenish color. So anecdotally, that's kind of telling me that they are ingesting this plant material because there's nothing else green in the container. They also represent, like I said before, a reasonable non-target insect because they inhabit a wide variety of habitats. In addition, their biology, culture, and test system is already known from the chemical side, so it's something that we can compare to as far as results and methods. And again, just to drive the point home, this is a 28-day exposure, which is more than enough time to see any effects from something that's just causing a starvation, something that might just take 7 days. Just to note the effect of a BT protein. The earthworms, again, while I haven't observed them to actually eat ingest plant material, that is what they normally eat based on textbooks. And comparing versus a control, they will actually gain weight as opposed to lose weight in some of these test systems, which is something that's suggesting that they are actually ingesting the plant material. Again, they represent a reasonable non-target organism. They share a common ancestor to insects. I remember from my graduate work that some of the ancestors to insects were worm-like, and so it seems to be a reasonable non-target organism because it's also so very common, something you'd see in a plant scenario in the field. Again, just like the springtail, the biology, culture, and the test system is already well known and established, and 14 days would certainly be long enough to see any effects from a protein like this. In addition, This is my last slide, so that works out well. In addition, some of these plant-incorporated proteins in the diet, we've taken and actually run assays versus the target insect just to confirm that the diet that these organisms are exposed to contains a biologically active protein, and that's been fairly effective in a number of studies. And can be done as several ways at the beginning and at the end of studies to, as like a dose confirmation step. And to make sure that during the processing of the diet that the proteins aren't broken down or denatured through either heating or mixing or any other processes. And that was just a quick run through. Any questions? The question was, what is in the artificial soil? The artificial soil is about, it's 35% coarse sand, 35% fine sand, 20% clay, and 10% peat. Are there any other questions? The concentrations of BT in the soil? I think it calculates to about 1.8 milligrams per kilogram of soil. What's that? Kaolin clay, if I'm pronouncing that right.